Test Talks, Episode 8. Hit it.
Welcome to the Test Talks Podcast, the place to go to geek out on software testing. And now your host, whose mission is to help you succeed with test automation, Joe Colantonio.
Hello, 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 and welcome to another episode of Test Talks, a podcast dedicated to all things test automation. I'm your host, Joe, from joecolantonio.com. I'm very excited to have on the show today Greg Pascal from gregpascal.com. Greg has been a speaker at multiple conferences like Star East, Star West, QAI, and QA Trailblazers. He's also an author of multiple white papers on test automation. And actually today we're going to be talking about one of those articles, Helpful Tips When Implementing Test Automation. And what's really awesome is how this came about. Greg contacted me on LinkedIn and pointed me to this article. And after reading it and speaking with Greg a little, we decided this would be a great topic for our Test Talk episode. So if you have a test automation success story you'd like to share on an upcoming episode, let's talk. Send your suggestions to feedback@testtalks.com or contact me on LinkedIn like Greg. And just a heads up for all you faithful listeners of Test Talks, next week there will not be an episode. I'm going to be away for business, and actually we have everyone over for Sunday dinner for Easter. So I'm going to be really busy doing yard work and getting the house ready for that. So next week, no episode, but we'll continue the following week. And now let's talk about test automation with Greg Pascal. Check it out. All right, Greg, welcome to Test Talks. How are you?
I'm doing great, Joe. Thanks for having me.
So before we get into it, Greg, can you just tell us a little bit more about yourself?
Sure. Well, I live here in the Dallas area, just north of Dallas, in a city called Plano. I'm a technologist. I have loved technology since being a young kid. Very fortunate to have someone mentor me at a very young age who in the area of electronics. And as a lot of us got into the area of computers, it generally started with tinkering in the electronic space, eventually evolved into getting into computers and blending those two things. That's very much how I got started as well. It's interesting. Some of the first automation I ever did was in that space. I was working for a company called Hughes Aircraft Company out in California, founded by Howard Hughes, ironically. This was in about 1986. And I got introduced to the Mac at the same time. I'm a big Apple guy. And Mac 2, a computer I could never afford on my own, by the way. It was crazy expensive. I can't even imagine. But there was a program called LabVIEW, and it's produced by a company out of Austin called National Instruments. And at that time, we were using a tool like this to automate hardware. We were actually testing satellite components and things that were launched up in space. They had the same devices, obviously, down in our lab, and we'd put it through the same rigors, and they needed something to automate that process. And so that's where I really started to do automation for the first time, was back then.
Wow, that sounds awesome, actually.
Yeah, it's really cool stuff, and it definitely has given some a way of thinking about automation that that you don't always get. But having that background has certainly given me an advantage in some case.
Awesome. So it sounds like you've had a lot of time to think about automation. And I know you recently wrote an article called Helpful Tips When Implementing Test Automation.
Yes.
That's on stickyminds.com. So why did you write this article?
Well, I'm doing some writing for Sticky Minds. I'm working on another piece as well. I think the company I work for now is in a similar place you run into with a lot of companies where they have some existing automation in place. I had seen this at a number of other employers as well. And there are some consistent things that continue to come up. And I thought, well, I'm getting a chance to, through this article, to hopefully influence and change some of the common mistakes that are made and help people step up on the right foot when it comes to test automation. And that was really a big incentive in saying, let's go ahead and do this thing.
Awesome. So yeah, I've noticed you have 8 main points. They're selecting a tool, use as intended, beware of the sales pitch, identify good automation opportunities, build a toolbox, object recognition expertise, adoption is important, and the end curve effect.
Yes.
So number one, selecting a tool. That seems to be one of the main questions I always get asked. Maybe not necessarily selecting a tool, but you know, what tools should I use to do automation? What technology? How would you answer that question?
Well, it seems like you obviously need to know, if I was writing, I'd want to know my target audience. And if I'm automating, I'd want to know my target applications. And so, of course, in today's environment, we're going to be running into so many things that are web, but we're almost into that next step now where we're dealing with services-based testing. Mobile is coming into play. Now, not every tool is going to be able to, you know, wear every hat to do those things. but certainly having a good sense of that is going to lead me down the road. I know it sounds basic, but it's ironic that sometimes people will get a tool and then find out it doesn't quite meet that need that they have, especially as services are starting to come into play. That's something to consider.
Excellent advice. Yeah, I definitely agree. I know, for example, someone using Selenium, a lot of times they'll ask, you know, how do I automate my VB app or something like that? It's for a browser, you know, mm-hmm. you can't use it. And I'm always amazed that someone didn't do a little more research before, you know, selecting their tool. It's almost like they hear a buzzword and that's what they want.
Isn't it ironic too, though? A lot of people will buy an HP tool set, a very expensive tool to get into, without really having a lot of detail. They've been kind of, you know, sold something through through some sort of presentation, and they make sometimes the same exact mistake, but on, you know, they've got a couple $100,000 on the line at that point in time.
Absolutely. And it may be in that case, all they need it for is a web application. So
that's a great point. Right. Yeah. And they've spent all that money and they could have gone to buy with something that would have done great just for web.
Absolutely. So along those lines, how do you watch out for sales pitches? What do you look for when someone's giving you a sales pitch, so you don't make those decisions based on, you know, some snake oil that someone's trying to push on you?
Well, I do think this is one of those areas you've got to use your gut, your discernment, because as someone who's used the HP tool set quite a bit, I've seen the sales pitch more than one time. I've actually seen it done again when it comes to mobile, believe it or not. I'm seeing the same kind of snake oil, as you put it. I think you really need to continually ask this question: does this seem a little too good to be true? A great area of this that almost always sells automation real well, but tends to be one of the biggest areas where people are like, ah, I thought it would, and it doesn't, is this whole concept of click and record. It's a fantastic sales tool. I think it's so appealing, but in reality, from at least my perspective, you really don't yield any real automation that's got some sustainability in a click and record world. It takes somebody with some expertise and development and some thought to really develop good automation. So when you're in that sales pitch sort of idea, if you're with those sales guys and they're saying, hey, you'll just do this and it'll work forever, go with your gut. It's probably telling you this sounds a little too good to be true, and I think it is.
Right, absolutely. And along the same lines of the record and playback type technology, luckily, I don't think I see as many people trying to use Selenium IDE like that, but there are instances where someone does try to use Selenium IDE to do their automation, doing the record and playback. And it's the same exact thing with QTP. Usually, I agree, that approach really isn't successful. It's not what you want to use for automation.
Sure. I have found, I think it's safe to say, a little tangent here, that when I first got into using the tools, I found that sometimes using the click and record just to learn some basic aspects of the tool wasn't terrible. I could learn some basic ways to identify objects and things like that. But really, I think you should stop at that point and say, okay, I've learned some basics. This is how it identifies an object or clicks a button or enters data in a field. I've got it. I'm going to go ahead and move on and write this from a code perspective at that point.
Absolutely. Yeah. I guess it has its place if you use it, like you said, as more, use it for like exploratory type automation, just to get familiar mm-hmm. with the application, the objects.
Yeah.
Definitely. How do you identify them once you have the tool selected? How do you identify what you should automate?
I think that's a great question, because it's ironic who sometimes determines what you should begin to automate. Most cases I've had a manager or someone who says, usually these are the words you hear: we're going to automate the entire regression suite. It's as if it's on a cue card and someone says, all right, it's time for the card, and they hold it up, and that gentleman or that person says that, and off you go. It sounds so good to begin with, and it absolutely is the wrong place to start. So I think you really need to start by, you know, learning to walk before you run. Joe, I was listening to one of your podcasts earlier today, and I think you had similar advice, that it's a good idea to start with something simple. And, you know, look for something particularly to help your manual testers. Automation's a very funny place to move in that it's easy to spend an enormous amount of time and hard to hit ROI on it. And those of us that are sometimes working under budgets and things like that know how important return on investment is in the long run. That can mean the difference between whether you continue to automate additional things down the road, or someone concludes, this is way too expensive, we don't need all these folks, and they put it on the shelf and that's the end of it. So I do think you need to find those candidates that you can automate and get a good return on. I would even shoot for something you can finish in a week or two. Look for the strength of that tool. If it's a UFT or QTP, you know, look for a client-based app or a simple web app. Web apps can be a little tricky at times, depending on latency. So you may not be there ready to jump in with things like synchronization yet, but Client apps can be a good place to start. Something that repeats maybe four or five steps. I love the opportunity to set up an environment where you can set up test data by just using automation to go through something maybe 100 times and just set up the test data that the manual testers would use. That would be a fantastic place to jump in.
Well, you know, I just want to second that. I love the idea of using automation for not necessarily 100% of something, but even if, like you said, for data population, I mean, you could save a manual tester so much time if they're manually entering things into a database or something to get into a certain state where they can then perform their tests. So I definitely agree those are areas people should really try to look at first.
Absolutely, Joe. I agree completely.
And, you know, it's also funny that I work for some companies sometimes where they say, we want 100% automation or 80% automation. I'm like, well, how much do you have automated now? None. So how are you going to get from 0 to 80? I don't understand. This is development. It just drives me crazy.
Don't you find those are good indicators, though, of the kind of the reality check of your environment, the people that are setting you off on the right foot? I think it's good for automation engineers to realize when they're hearing those things, before they even begin to set the expectation of, yes, I can, that they really set the expectation with that manager. Look, I want to move in this space as best I can to see us get good return on in this investment. But I want to make sure our expectations are realistic and, you know, try to set those expectations early on, because most automation engineers don't. And they begin to, you know, walk down that road even naively. And soon, you know, they're kind of on the hook for creating this miracle that's very hard to meet when those sort of things are posed.
I agree. You know, it's really hard because sometimes you don't want to come off as negative, but you also want to set expectations in a way that, yes, we should be automating. We should try to automate as much as we can. However, you know, let's do some level setting here to make sure we're in line.
Joe, maybe one strategy folks can do. I actually created a document on this one time. If you, as an automation engineer, are posed with that sort of challenge, at the very least, the strategy would be to break that application up into smaller chunks and get a win. I kind of show it in a cycle where you begin to evaluate the application. You break it into these manageable chunks, something, again, you can complete in a week or two. And we'll talk about hopefully the N-curve effect here in a moment, because that will come into play. But once the environment's a little more mature, something you could complete in a week or two. And then to complete that, go ahead and engage the person that's going to execute those scripts. Hopefully it's someone other than you and you're working with a manual tester. And then go back in for your second round of development would be a way to handle that reality that we're all confronted with. We've all been in that place.
Great. Yeah. If you can tell us a link or maybe post that on your website, that would be a great resource.
I'll try to get that up.
Awesome. Sounds good. Another thing that I see happen also is sometimes people put an awful lot of effort making an automation framework, and they don't think about the future. So say they leave and go to another group, but they still need to maintain this framework because they didn't make it in a way that it can be used by other people or it's easy to extend. So I think one of your other points is, that's another point of this article, that you should be able to make it so other people can reuse that framework easily.
Oh, you're speaking my language now. And you and I have both probably encountered automation that someone else had developed, and then we're told, well, we've automated it, here you go. And I was just talking with someone in my office not more than a few hours ago about this idea that it's actually, if you consider, it's pretty easy to automate something. It's another thing to build automation that's maintainable and sustainable in the long run. That's a different level of effort. And I do try to get that through with the people I'm working with, that don't just try to get to the finish line, but consider that you may never be the one that maintains this. And so how would you build it different? You know, take the time to build the documentation inside. And, you know, even in that case, I have come across engineers who say, I just don't document. I code only. And that may not be the best person on your team in the long run, because you do want that automation to have that sustainability. That's where the return on investment comes into play. You'll never hit it on the first execution. It's going to take you four or five runs down the road before you even come close to hitting ROI.
Absolutely. So this brings us to the next point, the N effect. What is the N curve effect?
Well, I love this concept. It was taught to me a number of years ago. And think about a curve that kind of has an N shape to it. It starts off with a steep slope, and then it kind of has a gradual slope on the backside. The N curve effect is what happens really with all forms of development, but automation definitely falls in this space. So when you're first given a project to automate, you begin to hit this N curve effect right away. And if you think about, as you progress up that N, if you were able to kind of climb it like a mountain, the first test case isn't going to be executed till you pretty much hit the top of that mountain or pretty close. So all of that work, all of that climb to begin with is just getting these foundational pieces in place. You're doing things like determining, breaking the application in different segments, how you might automate it. You're thinking about the way you're going to organize your scripts and your function libraries and reusable actions and your object repository, your naming conventions. All that comes into play. Likely the manager hasn't considered that at all, who's giving you the task to automate the entire thing. But through that end curve effect, you could be into this thing for quite a bit of time before you're able to show any kind of deliverable, which might just be one test case. It more than likely will to begin with. And I've seen this time take as long as a month, sometimes, to get over that first hump where you're able to show your first test case. Now, if you laid the groundwork well, your next test case should be that much faster and faster and faster, and you begin to come down the other side of that N. But it's so important to understand this N curve effect because it helps to set the expectation for the folks that have set you off to build this automation, that this is the place usually where it comes up. Someone says, well, don't you just click and record and you have a test case? And this is the time when you begin to explain, look, I need to put these pieces in place. I need to build a good raw object repository. I need to build out functions that I can reuse over and over again. And I need to be able to put these scripts in some sort of order so someone else can understand them as well as I, so they're in a logical format. And that's really the concept behind the N-curve effect. This has been such a valuable tool in communicating real-world automation that I can't emphasize it enough that people really consider it before they begin their first automation projects and those going forward from there.
Excellent. Yeah, I'm not sure if this is the same example, but I think a lot of times people, when they start a framework, they just start coding and go at it without thinking about some bigger principles. So I think if you have some principles, some best practices in place that you're presenting to everyone before they start automating, the better off you'll be also. So people aren't just starting to create automation code and all of a sudden it's like, oh, well, our naming convention isn't the same, or I didn't think about where this is going to go. Just simple things like that. If you have a nice solid foundation, that will help later on down the road if you think of these things first.
Yeah, absolutely. And you will exponentially find the next test case goes quicker and quicker. And by the way, one other piece here I'd like to talk to is a common area where automation is often told to be done is in the area of sanity checks or spot checks, if you will. And this can be an area that actually almost is counter to the N-curve effect. If you think about a sanity check or a spot check, sometimes they're in very disparate parts of the application. And so if that is what you're setting out to do, you do need to consider that you're going to climb that N over and over again. There will be parts that you'll reuse, but someone might come back and say, hey, you just automated one of those. Now you're doing your second and your third. Shouldn't you be able to leverage everything? Well, each time you're in a very different part of the application, you may have to climb aspects of that N curve that you hadn't had to do before. So when I think about my automation strategy, I usually try to consider like tests, things that are similar to the test I'm just about to automate. And I like to get a variety, a bunch of those done that have a similar feel to them or a similar path, so I can really take full advantage of all that climb up that end curve to begin with and, give me a great ride down the hill, producing a lot more automated test cases much quicker.
Awesome. Great advice. I like to change gears a little bit, and hopefully you'll remember this because I was listening to one of your other presentations. So I really like the story of the $5,000 giveaway. Can you tell us what the $5,000 giveaway was?
Okay. Well, certainly this is a story that's over 10 years old. I was working for a company in California. I was really new to the official role of a QA tester. This didn't necessarily tie in with automation, but it was as a tester. And I apply these principles still to this day. So I owned the testing of the .com site for this company. And so I would work very closely with the developer, and they were going to release this big contest they were having. They called it the $5,000 giveaway, and there was some part of the contest where you did something and you could win this prize. And included on that website was a phone number to call to do whatever you needed to do to enter this contest. Well, it dawned on me, I wonder, what happens if I dial this phone number? I should at least try that. That seems like something a good QA tester would do. And so I dialed it, and it went to HR or someplace within our company, and I And this woman said, hello. And I said, hi, this is Greg with the QA team. I'm just checking this number because there's this number's in this website and people are going to begin to call it regarding this $5,000 giveaway. Are you aware of that? Of course, she said no. I had no idea. And so lo and behold, we were able to catch a very young area that would have been quite embarrassing for our company before it had gone live. So that's the story of the $5,000 giveaway and catching a defect in a very unusual way, just making a phone call that was going to go live.
I love this story. And the reason why I love it so much is it really illustrates not everything can be automated and that manual exploratory testing is critical for any test effort. And the reason why I'm bringing this up is, once again, worked for companies where they say we want 100% automation. We want to get rid of manual testers. And I think this story is just a great example of how exploratory testing is critical and it's never going to go away. Manual testing will never go away. How would you automate something like that?
Exactly. Joe, you're so right. This is one of the myths that comes along with automation. And it's really hard on a company when they perceive that they've bought a tool and that this tool is going to take everybody's job away. Somebody may have thought that buying the tool, but the reality is I have not seen that happen to date in any company that I've been at. If anything, I found that we try to automate things that the manual tester just can't stand to do. It's some tedious process. And so what we try to do is automate those things that they really don't want to do anyway or are so tedious that there's so much work to do that they're easy to just miss an obvious validation bug or something like that. And get the manual tester back off on what they're doing well, which is using their brain and thinking outside the box and putting great tests in place.
So I actually got this story from, you have a really nice slideshow training module on your website called METS.
Yes.
So in a nutshell, what is METS and do you still use it today?
I do, and it's continuing to grow. METS was my very first presentation at Star West and East. I gave it at both, I think back in 2003 or 4. METS stands for Minimal Essential Testing Strategy. And you remember I mentioned that I owned the .com site for this company. Well, I was brand new to testing. And as most of the listeners know, and I'm sure you know, Joe, there aren't many places you go to learn QA. It's one of those things you learn by being mentored by someone or picking up by being part of. And that's exactly what happened. I had done testing in my past, but now officially wearing that QA role, I realized, well, I need to have a strategy for owning this .com site. I realized things were getting thrown over the wall at me. Sometimes I had less than an hour to test it before it needed to go live. So I literally just started a checklist on a scratch pad of, wow, if I don't have a lot of time, you know, make sure that the website loads, make sure, you know, these three links work, so on and so forth. And out of that came this Excel spreadsheet initially, which evolved into this whole METS methodology. It breaks down testing into a critical, high, medium, and low sort of categories. And you do take a category like page. Let's talk about web-based testing. And it would say in the high level, it would say make sure that the page loads completely. And then it would progress to various lower levels. Some low-level thing might be, and make sure there's a trademark at the bottom of the page or something like that, things that are less important. And as I evolved the METS strategy, it became more and more powerful to me, and it was remarkable because I could go, you know, a year or two, and all of a sudden I'd be like, I hadn't thought of that. I need to check, you know, for this particular scenario. So I would put a new category in and enter a particular test for that. So METS has been in place for over 10, 11, maybe 12 years now. It was being used by the Veterans Administration, being used by a lot of companies out there all over the place still to this very day. It's remarkable when I do a search on it. And it's quite honoring to find your name out there with people thanking you for this tool you built over a decade ago. Now, in my current company, we're revisiting METS. And we've created a METS for static testing. For those of you with an ISTQB certification, you'd be familiar with that concept. Where we're testing things before code is written, or we're testing documents. I just finished writing a new METS for testing graphs and charts and things on a website, the things you'd look for. So METS can be applied a lot of different ways. I've got METS for mobile I've worked on as well because mobile testing is so different. And as you said, it's on my website. If you go out there and look for minimal essential testing strategy, you'll you'll find that presentation you found, Joe, and you'll find the Excel spreadsheet you can download yourself and feel free to use.
You've mentioned mobile testing a few times. Mm-hmm. And I've noticed you also have a Missionware website.
Yes.
Are those apps you've developed?
That's correct. I have 7 apps in the iTunes store.
Very cool. So my question is then, from developing apps, what has that taught you about testing mobile apps? Has that helped you become a better tester?
It has. It certainly opened up my eyes to the fact that you can't test mobile like you test non-mobile apps. It has. You may have aspects that are overlap, but you have such a different challenge with mobile. Mobile needs to account for a loss of signal and an application closing midstream. Does it corrupt the data? There are a lot of things that just are different with mobile. Most people use a mobile app, you know, for 60 seconds and they close it. I remember a year or two ago, there was an app I really liked on the phone. It was very creatively done, but it took almost 30 seconds for it to load. They had a lot of data in the back end and things like that. And that, as cool as that app was, the developer didn't consider the target audience isn't going to wait around that long. They want that thing to launch within, you know, a split second, and you want to get into it, move around, get to what you want, and close it. And so that's just a different way of thinking about testing. It's not like a client app on your desktop where you're going to be in it for an hour or two. It's, or, you know, like a Microsoft Word or something like that. It's very, very different.
Awesome. So I'd like to talk a little bit more about mobile because it's actually something I haven't really dealt with much. You know, I've read stories of people with apps, actually the apps really draining the battery, things you have to test for I would never think of. So are there any tools or techniques you recommend for mobile testing? Like, do you want to avoid using an emulator because it's not really an instance of the app? How would you go about testing a mobile app, I guess, my question.
That's a good question. I think you definitely need to test on real hardware at some point. But, you know, Xcode, which is the Apple development environment, I'll speak to that because I haven't done much in the Android space, but at least in the Apple space, Xcode is free to download. By the way, you're going to need a Mac to test in this space, and it has its own challenges. You'll need to get the source code and some other things as well. But believe it or not, within Xcode, Apple's actually provided an automation tool in there. It's not as clean and pretty as it is to use UFT or some other tool, but it's the perfect kind of tool to do some unit testing and those sort of things that you might be able to help development out with, and you can actually build them out to be more robust. So, but I think you need to use both. I think it's safe to say you can do some of it at the emulator state. It may help you to be very nimble, where you don't need to deploy to the phone constantly. It's very tricky. As I got into mobile development, I have to tell you, it's by far the hardest development I've ever done in my life. You'd be surprised, even a very simple app, what it takes to build it from scratch and to really get it deployed to a phone so you can see it is no small task. It has quite a bit of moving parts. So it's not just like the developer is going to hand you, just deploy something to your phone and you're going to be able to test it. Those phones have to be set up with special activation so that code can be deployed to it so you can test it.
Cool. Are there any resources or books you would recommend to help someone to learn mobile testing or testing in general or automation?
A lot of the books by James Whitaker are some of my favorites. He used to work with or was a teacher at Florida Institute of Technology, and I met James at Star East and Star West, I think both. And he's got some great books, though. The one that I would suggest is How to Break Software, A Practical Guide to Testing. And then one of his students, and he co-wrote another book called How to Break Software Security. These have been in print for quite a while. They're excellent books. They're great references. Those are two that really stand out.
Great. So now I know you've spoken at quite a few conferences. Mm-hmm. So here's another question I always get asked, you know, what conference should I go to this year? Is there any conference you consider a must attend for software test engineers?
I think you need to get to Star West or Star East. To me, those are the conferences to get to. And you're going to make some incredible contacts in those places. So don't miss that point. Find the presentations that are of interest to you. And to be honest, if you get there and you don't like it, step out and find another one. It's expensive to get to these conferences, but don't neglect the opportunity to network. You would be amazed, the people that I've met at Star that I continue to stay in contact with to this very day, folks like Randy Rice or Dorothy Graham. These are some really leaders in our testing space who I'm able to reach out to from time to time and say, hey, I'm thinking about this, or maybe they've got some ideas, or I know they're going to be in town. And when you get a chance to meet folks like that, it really is going to help your skills become sharper as you get to that point where you're able to share with them and vice versa.
So let's change gears one more time. There's actually another site I came across that you own called recognizeanother.com.
Yes.
So Can you tell me a little bit more about what that site's about?
I can, and I'd love that you asked me about Recognize Another. So one of the things you'll find out about me, Joe, is I absolutely love working with people. I have a passion for it. And recognition is such an area that sometimes is bottled in a funny way in a company. Usually it's one-size-fits-all approach. And while I was working for a company a few years ago, that's exactly what they had. They had, this person does something great, and so we're going to recognize them at, you know, the company meeting every couple months. And what they didn't really take into account is not everybody likes to be in the limelight like that. Recognize Another, and there's actually tools on this website I'd love for people to go to it, recognizeanother.com, is really based on this idea that we all have different ways we receive recognition. Well, some people like words of affirmation, just encouraging words. Some people like gifts, and they find that very rewarding. Some people like some time off. Give that person a couple hours, they'll go home early and be with their family. And one size doesn't fit all when it comes to recognition, and this site talks a lot about that. There are actually tools on that website, by the way, that a manager can use so that he can basically inventory I call them recognition styles of his employees, so he knows the appropriate way to recognize his team in a way that's meaningful to them individually. I just love that you asked about it because one of my big passions is mentoring and helping and training people, trying to help them really achieve the things that they're naturally wired to do. And this site goes hand in hand with helping me to try to do that as effectively as I can.
Is there one thing you see over and over again in your long testing career that most people working in QA are doing wrong?
I think the one area that really stands out to me when it comes to automation in particular, when you use a tool, you want to use that tool as it was intended, as it was designed, not as you discover it. My good friend Mark Benson, who I work with now, he and I talk about this quite a bit. And I thought of an illustration. I've seen this happen often, especially in the test automation space. Someone has given a box of software, and they said, here's your automation tool, go ahead and, you know, go conquer the world with it. And that poor guy has to go and figure out from scratch how he's going to go ahead and do that. And he doesn't really have any choice but to figure it out as he discovers it along the way. I want to encourage those companies, those managers, those folks that are buying these tools to make sure they set aside some budget to send these folks off to school. I was so fortunate to get a chance to go to HP to learn. At the time, it was QTP. It's now UFT. That helped me have such a foundation to walk in the tool the way HP intended that tool to be used. It's given me such an advantage over and over again. So that's really a big one I see often, is people use these automation tools as they discover them. And it becomes a viral problem in that once you learn to use this tool incorrectly and you train someone on it, they begin to teach more people how to use the tool incorrectly. And before you know it, it's much like a virus. It spreads and spreads and spreads. And pretty soon, kind of the whole variety of talent in your area seems to no longer be following true best practices. They're just following what they know, which, by the way, they often call best practices. Best practice is usually their practice, from what I have found. So that's a really common mistake I see.
I really agree with this point because, you know, it's not just a lot of times QTP, UFT gets a bad rap, but the same issues that people have with QTP with the lack of training are the same things people encounter with other tools like Selenium. That if they don't get that training, they just repeat the same bad habits over and over again, regardless of the tool. So over time, then that tool gets a bad rap because people aren't being trained on it correctly. So I definitely agree with you on that. Training should be more of a priority on these tools with best practices. Okay, Greg, before we go, what is one piece of actionable advice you can give someone to improve their testing skills? And let us know the best way to find or contact you.
I would say this idea behind making sure that you're getting the proper training before you're stepping out into the tool would be to get the training that you need to use the tool as it was designed to use. Go back to your management. Even if you find a webinar or something online that you can take that's going to help step you off in the right direction, make sure that training is something you can tie right back to the vendor or some trusted source, so you know it's not bad information being taught to you. As we've discussed earlier, there's a ton of bad information out there in these tools and how to use them as well. I definitely think that's a good place to start, and something I would highly recommend for folks. You can easily find me online. Just do a search on Greg Pascal. That's P-A-S-K. And also connect with me on LinkedIn. That's a great way to find me. And of course, there are some articles on Sticky Mind that'll probably come up with a Google search as well. But certainly through LinkedIn would probably be a fantastic way to connect with me directly.
Awesome. Well, Greg, you know, I really appreciate all the work you're doing. And I think we're very similar. I think we both love to learn and share. So I really want to thank you for taking time out of your day to speak with us today.
Sure will. I sure appreciate it, Joe. Loved it. I hope people can use the resources I've got out there online and that they will really benefit them in the testing work they're doing. Thanks for having me today.
Sounds good. Thanks. Thank you for joining me on Test Talks. And remember, you can find the links to everything of value that we talked about today in the show notes at www.testtalks.com/08. And as always, test everything and keep the good. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to the Test Talks podcast. Head on over to www.testtalks.com for full show notes, amazing blog articles, and other automation awesomeness.